Good morning, everybody. It is Monday. My name is Tom Scott. I'm chairman of the Nantucket Project. Joining me is RP Eddy. RP, I am just south of Hannibal, Missouri, in a town called Louisiana, Missouri. Hannibal, Missouri is the home, the birthplace of Mark Twain.
Yeah.
The Tom Sawyer caves are there. I read an abridged version of Tom Sawyer yesterday. I hadn't read it in a long time, and I wanted to dust up on my Tom Sawyer Huck Finn. And it's been quite a journey. I mean, Friday night we got to the source of the Mississippi, Lake Itasca, which is sort of in northern Minnesota. And then we've been following the Great River Road on the way down, talking to a lot of people, asking a lot of questions. It's been fascinating, really. It's just been fascinating. You know, we're certainly not in Kansas anymore. You know, there's a mix of things you see. There really are a mix of things that you see. It's not as maybe predictable as some people might think, or I guess it depends on your point of view. But it's always nice to sort of get out front and really be in these places to really see what's going on. And I will just, before we dive in, I woke up this morning at a Holiday Inn Express in Hannibal, Missouri. And when I came downstairs, when I was coming down the elevator, I could smell the bacon. And I thought, oh, I didn't think you could do, you know, the restaurant thing. But no, I got down, you know, the free buffet was set up. People were eating. No one had on masks. It was like normal days. I was really surprised. And frankly, I was a little creeped out just for my own safety and for their safety as well. I don't want to be all judgy of them. You know, I have my own opinions on it. But it's pretty fascinating that at this moment in this time, I'm in a place where, you know, this is sort of the way things are going. This is sort of your neck of the woods, right? You have some familiarity with this part of the world.
Yeah. Mequon, Wisconsin, right outside of Milwaukee, is where I had the great privilege to go to high school, University of Milwaukee, which was an awesome aspect to my growing up.
And was the Mississippi River... It's such a beautiful place, and there's so much in the way of recreation. Was it a place people went to, like, go on vacation and whatnot?
No, we were on the other side of the state, but we went to all the lakes, you know, Lake Geneva being the big one. There's lake, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, these are all lake areas. People love water, and so we were up by the little lakes, Oconomowoc, all the little lakes, in Lake Michigan, but not the river. The river was too far away.
So yesterday, oh, I'm sorry, 2 days ago, we just happened upon a protest. We were there right for the beginning of the protest, and here it is. And this sort of stretched for quite a while. You know, this is a group of people who want to be back outside. If you notice, I don't know if we're going to see it in this shot, but you go by and you see a family that's pulling like a little aluminum boat. And in the boat are the children. There they are. There they are. Did you catch that?
Hopefully they were just going slowly. That was part of the parade/protest.
Yeah, so it was, you know, it's just a very interesting point of view. And you know, they do use the term fake news quite a bit. They do think there's a massive overreaction. They're very upset about the state of their economy. They don't speak of it as, they speak of it as something that is from afar, which, to be fair, so did we. You know, if you go back 2 months and if you're in our neck of the woods, that's generally how people kind of thought about it. And that's their point of view. That's how they come at it. So, you know, what I would say is, you know, when you get closer to it and you feel the nuance of it and you interact with people, it's a little upsetting, but I think it's less, I think the way it's characterized back in our neck of the woods is frankly just a little bit unfair. Unfair in its specific attack on them themselves. Because I would make the argument that the real issues are coming from media, communication, leadership, etc. Curious how you react to that.
I like your summation too. I like the narrative. I like the picture. I like kind of being back in the good land. I like the family in the bass boat. That's a bass boat, by the way. There are people making a lot of money trying to divide us. There's people that are going to have a lot of power coming out of how they divide us in these elections. And there's a virus that's already making us terrified and animalistic and limbic and responsive and reactive. that's already dividing us. And trust, T-R-U-S-T, is so critical right now, and there are people actively eroding it. It's like people out there trying to make us not trust each other. And they make money on it, and they win elections on it, and their countries become stronger on it. I'm speaking of China and Russia as well. So, and you put that all within the fog and uncertainty of a virus. So that's where we are. And I think your point's a great one, right? Like, we closed our business a little earlier than everybody else. And I took my kids out of school a little earlier than everybody else. And I, even in our hometown, taking my kids out of school, I had everyone from my wife to my in-laws to my kids to some teachers looking at me side-eye. And I'm really glad I did it. I wish I'd done it a little earlier because it wasn't here, right? If it wasn't, yeah. I don't get it. It's not there, Tom. It's not really there. It's not there. You know, I don't know if this stat's right, but it's close. Certainly a third of the cases have been in New York City. In America, a third of the cases have been in New York City. For the rest of the country, New York City is that weird place on the island that is full of crazy rich people and drug addicts and, you know, just Hollywood movies. It's, you know, they come visit once in a while. There's a lot of Americans never been to New York City, but it's a different country. A third of the cases were in New York City, so they can separate. A third of the cases, a third of the deaths at least, may have been in elder care facilities. That's also a place we don't really have that much connection to if you're just, you know, run-of-the-mill American, right? So if two-thirds of the cases were places that aren't part of my life, and then a third are sprinkled around a country the size of America, getting down to, what is the math on that, 23,000 other deaths, and there's none in my hometown, there's none in my county, maybe one in my county, and if I don't count elder care facilities, all of a sudden, what's going on here?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't get it. I want to go to work. Why wouldn't wearing wearing masks? I don't see it. So, you know, now the problem is no one's on the science side lying. There's no big cover up. There's no big fake here. This isn't a hoax. There's an actual pandemic sweeping the world. And it's killing lots and lots of Americans. It's the number, what is it? The number one leading cause of death in the world right now, I think, was the statistic today. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's going to be there too. And that's really bad. Now, you know, I took my kids out of school in our hometown 1 or 2 days earlier than the school shut down. Probably didn't benefit from it. So if they wait another week or two, whatever it is, maybe they won't pay a high cost. You know, hopefully they'll be getting a lockdown or whatever it takes. Social distance, wear masks, be aware, wash your hands at a point when it helps them. So let's just hope that's what ends up happening. Well, but better than that, let's hope the disease doesn't get there.
You know what has such a lasting impression? So the way you just described it is exactly what I hear. First thing you'll hear out of somebody's mouth is, it's really not around here. So if you could imagine being in an area where...
What state? Are you in Missouri right now?
Yeah, I'm in Missouri.
I'll look up Missouri while we're talking.
We were in Iowa. We were in Illinois. We were in Indiana. We were in Minnesota. And but their businesses are closed, right? So while there's none of this stuff around, their businesses are closed. And the leftover residue of the basket of deplorables is such a big deal. It's such a real thing. You know, there's this sense that those people in that place you described, New York City, look down on these people as just horrible things. Horrible. Well, I mean, the list was...
That's what they believe.
And that's what they believe.
Maybe some don't.
So
Missouri...
Yeah, let me clarify. What I'm trying to say is when that label they were given and then all the things that made up a basket of deplorables, racist, misogynist, and that long list, stays with people. They think, oh, you hate us. You think we're stupid. You think we're unsophisticated. You think we're all these bad things. And those, when those people say, hey, you can't work now, and there's this disease that you really don't feel around you, it just doesn't translate very well. So that's really what I'm saying. It's this leftover, which, by the way, it lives on. I mean, Trump stokes this stuff. It's, you know, it certainly lives on. I'm not suggesting it doesn't, but But that divisive thing doesn't make this problem any easier. And they're definitely angry right now. Definitely.
Well, let's quickly do this deplorables thing. It's not just you hate us, you look down on us, you call us racist, misogynistic, ism. It's you also, you being the coastal elites, you being the, you know, personified by Hillary Clinton, let's just put a name to it, right? That's what they're all, she became the crystallization of all their concerns about elites looking down on them or coastals looking down on them. So it's not just you are an ism or an ist. It's also you're denying my Bible.
Like, right.
You're denying my rights. You're denying documents and beliefs that I cherish and hold super deeply. And you're telling me they're not right. So I got no time for you. And that's not wrong, right? I mean, that's a lot of what these behaviors are. The other comment you made, these people are telling me to lock down. Because the federal government has decided to completely cede authority to states, which is totally unusual. Just to make sure we understand that. In a national emergency, the federal government, in almost every instance, in fact, in every instance, the federal government leads. In this instance, the federal government has decided not to lead. Take it as you will. It's certainly not the right decision, in my opinion. But federal government's decided not to lead. So these people tell us to lock down in Missouri, in Illinois, in Minnesota, and all the states you're going to. These people are their local governors,
yeah. Just to be clear. But that's been a recent. I mean, there was the original period where Trump said you got to go home, and now yes, it is turning into that. Tomorrow, RP, we're going to be with a woman. She runs the YMCA. It might be the YWCA in Pottstown, Pennsylvania. And I sat in on Friday on a Zoom call with a bunch of sort of civic leaders, mostly around the East Coast. But among the things she some of them were the women from the Native American Reservation who were at Nantucket Project last year. But she was telling me the story of how in her area, the children went back to school a week ago today. They were out of school for 2 months because the school system was unable to do distance learning. And what they've done at the Y is they've turned it into effectively a soup kitchen. You know, they basically make food. They've never done that before. You know, they had to figure out how to do that. And the challenge of children being out of school, but also not doing the distance learning thing has just been so overwhelming. And the anger on the call and the upset. You know, and then again, she's going to be with us tomorrow, Kapu, so we can talk to her about it. There's so many layers to this story. Like, there's not enough hours in the day to peek at all the layers. You know, and to hear that, I didn't know that. I didn't know there were school systems that had effectively shut down for 2 months. But that's the way it is. So, you know, those kinds of things. I was speaking to a woman in northern Minnesota who's had a restaurant, I think she said, for 28 years, and she thinks this will be her last. Because not only has it been closed, but she also doesn't think people are going to come back once it opens. She's more in the lakes area, which is more tourist driven, which, as she said, people from Minneapolis, I think people in the cities tend to be more the mask wearing, you know, types. I'm totally generalizing here, of course, but it's kind of devastating to hear it all. And when you hear it, you know, up close and you hear that sort of sentiment and this sense that, it doesn't feel good to be called stupid. It doesn't feel good to feel powerless and to feel like you're struggling economically. And generally speaking, they have this sense that people from our part of the world think of them in those ways. And that just makes this whole thing so much more difficult. Anyway, there's so much more to this and I'm just at the beginning of the process. So I'm kind of reacting in real time, but it's been an incredible experience. It's just an amazing experience. And by the way, most of these smaller cities, they were having problems long before this came along.
You talked about layers to the story. What's fascinating is in Missouri itself, there's actually only been 500 deaths. So it's not like it's a dramatic medical story of COVID-19 in Missouri. But part of what's happening is all the layers of America, the realities of America are becoming a little more obvious to us, a little more in focus. All the different levels of people who are dying and getting treatment and not getting treatment and people waking up to the fact that school systems often serve as feeding centers and baby care centers and allow mom and dad to go to work in the meat packing factories and all these things that we're learning about our fellow citizens. That's part of what's happening here, right? And you getting on the road and traveling down the Mississippi is awesome. And you're going to help us you know, from one part of the world, a part of the country, see what's going on in another part of the country. And that's what we need to do. So there's a lot of silver linings to this very, very dark cloud. One of them might be that we get to understand the experience pre-corona of our fellow citizens in a way that we didn't previously, because we're opening our eyes up to this right now. Much like we opened our eyes up when Trump won, by we, I mean the East Coast elites, much like they opened their eyes up to the reality of the Americans who would vote for Trump. A lot of people on the East, on the coast, were shocked that people would vote for this vulgarian. And then they had to go read Hillbilly Elegy and other things to learn that, oh, there's middle Americans who believe in the Bible and don't have enough to eat all the time and work really, really, really hard at high risk and low pay. I forgot about those people. That's sort of what's happening right now, too.
Yeah, I'm going to add one part to that, because I can't help but go here, and I apologize. You may even know where I'm going. It's, if you were to take like the worst quality of what a Trump voter might do and then put a really bad word and you attach to it, that's the story that's going to get told on MSNBC. That's the story that's going to get told. It's going to be the story of just this horrible person and this horrible term, maybe racist or whatever it might be. And if you just sort of collectively think like one of those equals one of those, and I do not like them, You completely removed the nuance of the humanity of who these people are and the reason they make the choices that they make. I mean, you mentioned Hillbilly Elegy, which I read the book, and it's a good book, but even that book is very anecdotal. You know, it just sort of it takes you into a little part of that world. That part of that world is everywhere. And statistically speaking, if you look at just, you know, incomes and whatnot, I will also tell you that there's the Bernie Sanders thing is a big thing around here. You know, there's that, if you're a lefty, you're a Bernie lefty. There's a lot of that, you know. I've heard it time and again. Like, Bernie, I prefer Bernie
and Trump appeal to a similar aspect of the American voter who wants to destroy the system because the system doesn't like them. The system wants to destroy me. I want to destroy the system.
Yes.
And the kind of things you're describing about how, again, we're using massive generalizations here, but how, you know, let's say middle income, middle America views the elite's view of them, is that they're not out for me, right? They're out to get me. They're out to use me, right? They don't respect me and things I hold dear. And so I want to break the system. So Bernie and Trump both are break the system guys. Yeah. And by the way, Bernie and Trump are the first of many more Bernies and Trumps to come, because this particular dynamic right now we have around the Electoral College in the Rust Belt states, of which you are skirting, allows those voters to have a very, very outsized influence on the election. Right. Yeah. So Trump won by, if you actually go down to the zip codes where Trump won the counties to win the states to win the Electoral College, it's something around 100,000 votes. If they had swung differently, Hillary Clinton would have been our president. Now, Hillary won by millions of votes in the popular vote. She lost the electoral vote because of about 100,000 votes in those counties. And that's sort of where you are now. And the reason is largely what we said. It's that you hate me, I hate you. And so Bernie and Trump are the ones who respect me, or at least they want to blow the system up.
Well, but the thing I was going to say is, if you actually drive and you do this, because I've done this so many times, it's very difficult to find people who are like these super evil types. They're definitely out there. I know they're out there. But generally speaking, you walk into a store, you talk to people about their opinions. They don't hold all those extreme opinions that you might think they do. They're very friendly to you. They're very polite to you. Their intentions are very hopeful and good. That's the norm. Like, that is the norm. And you know, so if you actually live in that no nuance world, you actually live in a lack of truth. It's untrue. I mean, you have at it, but it's actually just not a reality. Anyway, it's nice to see it. Well, let me clarify that. It's very interesting and intense to see it at this moment. It's not the first time I've seen it. At this moment, it does make me anxious, because they are angry at some of the ways they feel like they're being treated. And they're scared for all the reasons a lot of people are: money, health, et cetera.
Yeah, this is a fascinating conversation, because we're using broad generalizations and kind of inductive bias about samples to talk about populations. And it's accurate in as much as the MSNBCs and the Fox refine that message and push it back out. But it's at every individual, you know, data set of one, it's inaccurate, right? And that's what you're seeing when you walk into these, you know, get to meet folks. The thing that's a great example is the surprise that people, I've had conversations where we've talked about police departments in super white, well, not even white, super towns in, let's say, deep Alabama, that where there's lots of Confederate flags flying. The police department spent a lot of time chasing racists and the KKK and hate crimes, right? The white sheriff or the white police department in super racist towns, in some instances, spent a lot of their effort chasing racist behaviors in the KKK. And when people see that, they kind of forget that the what we're generalizing as a very racist town because we see a lot of Confederate flags is in fact an outlier group of evil people that do not represent, in that instance, the population of whites in that neighborhood, for example. Yeah. And that, in fact, most of the whites are fighting against the racists.
Yeah. Well, it's it is an important story of our times. And we're going to, I mean, you've been saying this, post game on this one will be really intense and long. And it's going to involve so many different elements, from income to food to access to education. Yeah.
The post-game, like hot wash, the review, the commission will be interesting, but the changes that are going to be accelerated by this are going to be fascinating, right? So if it's true that more people are being exposed to the media now, which is probably true, and if it's true that a lot of people are able to make their way through the biased medias on the spectrum, on the ends of the spectrum, and are able to get sort of more realities about their fellow Americans, for example, in an American context. And then if it's true, third presumption, that they're going to see, let's take East Coast elites, that, wow, I didn't realize, for example, that millions of American children don't get meals if they don't go to public school. I didn't know that was happening in my country. This is one piece of news. Then, if, three presumptions, then will we do anything about it when we're post-vaccination, right? Will this change our body politic? Will we now think about things like universal basic income more generously? Will we now wake up and say, whoa, I didn't quite understand until this happened how tough life was for many of my fellow citizens. Thereby, we're going to have a more liberal agenda in the House and the Senate. I don't know. I'm not, but nor am I suggesting that should be the way. But how is the body politic and decision-making going to change based on some possibility that we have a revelation about the least of us amongst us now?
Yeah. Well, 08, I hear about 08 a lot. Deplorables, I hear about that a lot.
This What's that mean? So you actually have a conversation with someone in a diner and deplorables comes up? Like, can you tell me a story?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, it's, you know, if you were to ask somebody, why aren't you wearing a mask? I'll just say it politely, because I don't think I need one. It's like, yeah, no, I understand. I'm just curious. And I said, are you afraid? Not really. No, I'm not really afraid. I'm angry. But why? Because all our businesses are closed. And do you like Trump? He's like, you know, there haven't been one person I met, I know they're out here, who don't have a little bit of a laugh. You know, it's kind of, he's our clown kind of thing. Yes. And he's a clown. Like that's sort of the next reaction.
Awesome.
And then it's like, well, you know, what do you think when you watch the news and you hear people giving this other information? And then it's like, I don't trust them. It's fake news. I was like, well, why do you say it's fake news? And it, you know, and at some point you get to, they hate Rachel Maddow. And when somebody calls us deplorables, you know, and you'll say the deplorables, I'm one of the deplorables. Like that's the kind of line they'll say. It's, you know, it's still in there. I mean, that's 4 years ago, right? So that's how I get there. You know, it's just sort of walk down that path. And I think when you sort of start with the fact that, see, I'm not angry that I'm not at work, but maybe it's because I don't need to be angry that I'm not at work, or I'm maybe a little understanding that it's a very complex system and there's a lot of stuff to work out. And I don't want to be the one who's yelling and screaming at everybody where they're trying to get work done. But I might get angry soon, right? I might be like, you know, now these regulations are ridiculous. Like you could imagine me making that turn. Unfortunately, a lot of people start there. They assume that thing you just said is stupid and wrong because you don't like me. So I just said a lot. And as you can tell, like I'm unpacking this as I go.
No, this is awesome. Other than the fact you probably missed Mother's Day. I'm really glad you're doing this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting time. And you know, another thing is people have time to talk.
Yeah.
You know? So I'll keep us up to date here. I mean, I got more to say, but I'll show us more as we go. I mean, the Mississippi River and this road, the Great River Road, I highly recommend the Great River Road. I've never been on the Great River Road. I've crossed the Mississippi many times. But essentially, you know, in northern Minnesota, it's hard to follow. It kind of twists and turns because, it, at the very upper end of the Mississippi, it's a bunch of lakes. And then you can see like, oh, there's a thing. And then at some point, it turns into this big road. And on each side of the road, there's a each side of the river, there's a road, and each side of the river is a different state. Like I could be in Missouri right now, or I could go into Illinois right now. You know, that it goes that way all the way down the state.
So Tom, you gotta do one thing for me. You have to download the soundtrack to the Hollywood show Big River, words and music by the famous and great Roger Miller.
Okay.
And play it. Play it one time through, you know, for 45, 60 minutes. I promise you, you're going to love it.
All right.
And particularly as you're going down that, as you're going down, you know, the Mississippi. And I'm thinking about, you know, my buddies, Jim and Graham and the great Jane Allen, who exposed us to all this. You're going to love it.
Okay, I'll do it. So speaking of content, and I'll use this as a way to shift over Donald Trump, I watched American Dharma 2 nights ago, which is a Errol Morris film about Steve Bannon, and very powerful, like very, very well done. You know, Errol Morris is
among
the best, and it just gives you a very great insight into who he is and why.
For a documentary about Bannon?
It's Bannon, yeah. It's Bannon.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, it's all about Bannon. And, you know, it'll give you, like, today on his Twitter feed, I'm sorry, on his Instagram feed, Trump posted something that is something like, you know, now that you like, thank you for the investigations, now it's your turn. Like, that's his Instagram post. And if you see that, you know right away, like, well, I mean, it's always interesting to what degree people give themselves credit for each of these things, but I'm sure Bannon had a heavy influence on Trump. It just makes so much sense in light of sort of seeing that film and being where I am, you know, because that's another one is people think that the whole Mueller investigation, like we spent 2 years investigating something that turned out to be nothing. That's their point of view. Like, what a waste of time and energy. So anyway, there's a lot of action going on inside the White House in just in terms of the illness itself. I'm just curious how you feel about that with the diagnoses that are sort of close in.
I have friends working in the White House. Some of them are going to work. One of them's a new mother. I was surprised that, and I shouldn't have been, but let's just understand what we're talking about here. So I think some senior, very senior people around the vice president have tested positive. One of the joint chiefs has tested positive. And I think another senior, and Lamar Alexander, right? Tested positive, Senator Lamar Alexander, who's a Republican, one I hold in high esteem, actually. And so now all of a sudden we have some very serious leaders in this country positive with the disease. I'm surprised it happened, but I guess I shouldn't be, right? So when the president goes to a factory and doesn't wear a mask, guess what? You know, he didn't get it, but if people are acting like that, you know, the disease is going to come get you. I think we've kind of learned that. So I was a little surprised that they're getting infected. I'm overwhelmed with hope that they heal and that it doesn't rip through the White House. That could be extremely destabilizing and dangerous and a national security threat. And there's things understanding inside government. There's a group of extremely dedicated, unbelievably nonpartisan people who work on two programs. One's called ECG, the extension of constitutional government, which means how does the government persist in the wake of a lot of deaths in the line of succession. And there's one called COG, continuity of government, COG. And that's a similar question. And, so feel good that there's serious people making sure America persists in the, if a missile hit the White House, the Constitution goes on, right? And like that's going on, that's good. But I think there's some lessons from these stories. One is about the testing of the member of the Joint Chiefs. He's the man in charge. I think it's a man in charge of the National Guard. He tested positive, negative, positive for the disease. And I heard a commentator the other day say, that's the thing with this disease. It goes away and the tests come up negative. Wrong. It's not inaccurate. Once you get past the eclipse period, and which is about a three-day period, where you get exposed and you're asymptomatic and you don't have enough viral load for any tests to work, right? So you get exposed, it's in your blood, you're probably not transmitting it, but you are infected at such a low amount that most tests don't note it yet. That's called the eclipse period. Then you enter a period where you're symptomatic or not, but you are contagious. You call it the viral shedding period, whatever you want to call it, post-eclipse period. People get, at no period in time past that eclipse period is the viral load so low that you don't appear to be affected by a proper test. The reason that a member of the Joint Chiefs had a yes test and a no test and a yes test is the testing is still not accurate. That's a big deal. So that's a lesson right there. Even at that level, we don't have enough highly accurate tests. Lesson number one. Well, lesson number one was, even if you think you're above it, if you think you don't have to wear a mask, if you think that you don't have to follow the restrictions in your workplace, for some silly reason, the disease will come get you. So that's what's happened throughout the White House. And number two lesson is, even there, they don't have testing that works well enough yet. So those are pretty relevant pieces of news.
Can you give us some sense, the best you can? I know you're not there, but this has to be hard. I mean, divorce for a moment, if you can, if you're listening, your distrust, dislike of Donald Trump, whoever it might be. He's the president of the United States. He's inside the White House. The economy's in disaster. We have this disease issue flying all over the place. And now there's people close in getting sick. The media hates you. It's got to be intense in there, right? I mean, how characterize it if you can, as best you can. And maybe compare it to other crises you've been around. It's got to be a tough go.
So let's split it into the president and everyone else. And I'll try to be tight on both so I can cover both. So a lot of leaders want the chance to be great. Teddy Roosevelt, who wanted so badly to be a great man, Winston Churchill, who wanted so badly to be a great man that they put themselves in extraordinary physical harm in war simply so they could get noticed, simply so they could be leaders, begged for crisis. They wanted crisis so they could show what great leaders they were and so they could lead their nations to the right dimension, right? So some leaders, many leaders, really, really want crisis as a time to define themselves in their presidency. Many of us who are leaders now, CEOs, leaders of families, leaders, whatever you are, you know you are really being tested right now. This is a moment. You think you're a leader? Try it now. Try it. This is it. You think you're a leader? Now try it under a tough circumstance. Are you still a great leader? Are you still inspiring people? Are you able to get yourself together and others around you? Are you being followed? A leader means you're being followed. Are you being followed or not? So most leaders want this moment. They don't want the crisis in their country. George Bush didn't want 9/11 to happen. Lincoln did not want the American Civil War, but Lincoln would have probably gone on as an average president if it hadn't occurred, right? But he became one of the great presidents because his leadership was able to manifest into a victory for the Union. You get the story. This president doesn't appear to want that mantle of leadership. Now back to Bannon. Bannon in January, I think late January, early February, wrote about this and said to the president via Twitter, this can be your Churchillian moment. This can be your moment to lead us against this enemy. You know, it should be pandemic all the time. You know, go get it. And the president decided not to. I'm not criticizing or not. I mean, I think you understand my point of view on that. But he didn't want this to happen. He didn't want to have this as a leadership opportunity. And he kind of wanted it to go away. And unfortunately, the virus, when you want it to go away, it loves that. And it just comes racing at you. And that's where we are now. So that's the leadership dynamic, being a president. The staff. What's it like to work inside a place under crisis? I know a good friend of mine was in the White House last week, at the end of the week, and saw the vice president and a bunch of other senior people and was going to go see the president. The president wanted to see him, but he would have had to gotten tested before he was going to go in to see the president. So the news now is saying, oh, they're starting new testing in the White House. They've been doing testing in the White House at least last week before the news broke. And that's got to be a situation of, you know, a tense situation, high anxiety and panic. Other folks I'm talking to in the White House, they already feel besieged by the disease. I think a lot of people there are extraordinarily disappointed that they aren't leading from a federal level like they would like to. They're probably disappointed in their president in some ways, but they really, really feel like this is the world coming at them. So much as folks in Missouri feel like they're considered deplorables and the world's out to get them, the White House feels that way now too. They're embattled. They think China did this to us. They think to some extent it's a Democratic hoax. And they also think that the epidemiological experts in the world are using this to fight against them. And there's increasing scrutiny against Fauci and Birx, who are sort of controlling the agenda. And that's what's happening there. So it's an embattled point of view, which is what happens when you're only being reactive and you're not fighting back. And a disease like this leaves you no corner, no quarter, if you aren't working aggressively against it. And that's what's happening in this White House.
And do they, would you say that they are, what do you do? Do you end up compartmentalizing all the other issues you've got to deal with as an executive branch? Or you just,
you think, we'd like to think of our government as this multifaceted organization that can chew bubblegum and walk at the same time. And under any president, that's not really the case, right? I mean, you know, all water flows to the lowest basin. Right now, it's all efforts to fighting this disease, or at least trying to fight the disease one way or the other. And so lots of things are being left in the lurch, for sure. But, you know, I'll learn a little bit more, but I'd imagine it's a moment of dismay, embattlement, and panic in and around President Trump right now. The election now looks much more at risk than before. Don't forget, October, November, December, January, our economy was ripping. I mean, it was doing very well. Yeah. Now, of course, we have the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, and we're on our way to be worse. Often the presidency is linked to the economy, almost always. I know for sure they are looking extremely closely at the 8 battleground states, the states you're going through, Tom. That's where all the attention is. One thing I want to really watch out, like a hawk, is I really hope that federal aid and federal support is not unduly biased towards those states versus other places in the country and the union that need aid. And let's hope that doesn't happen. That would be a real scandal.
Dr. Scott Atlas, I don't want to go into this in depth, but you know, he's the Stanford MD who really talks, I would say, more radically than many in his field about sort of the way we should go about reemerging. You can comment on that if you like, but I'm just curious if you have any major change in point of view of that question. And again, you know, for me, I continue to believe that there's this emotional part of this reemergence that's going to become so critical. There are all the tactical elements, of course. But, you know, one of the things I would say I'm on a lot of Zoom calls, and there are a lot of different kinds of Zoom calls. And, you know, there are areas of this country that are like super afraid of so many things. And there's other parts of the country that are super blasé about it. And no matter what the government says, they're going to have to deal with sort of that whole spectrum. I'm just curious how you would react to any of that.
All right. So let me first say one thing that will be a little off-putting. When we did our work on Cassandras and try to figure out what warning one should listen to and what warnings one can sideline, not listen to right away, we looked at obviously warnings that were accurate and ignored and led to catastrophe. That's called a Cassandra warning. And we looked at warnings that were strong and heeded and turned out not to be the case. Population bomb by Paul Ehrlich. There are a number of other things where the world really thought catastrophe was looming, took really expensive steps to prevent it, and then the catastrophe didn't manifest. Not because of preventive action, just because it wasn't there in the first place. The warner was wrong. So call it Chicken Little and Cassandra. Part of what we learned about Chicken Littles versus Cassandras is we're talking generally about highly technical insights. If someone's giving me a warning and I'm going to change national policy based on their point of view or a group of scientists' point of view, they better be experts, right? It better be the exact type of person that is credentialed over decades, proven over decades, educated over decades to be the person on this little issue, this razor thin issue where I'm going to listen to them or not. Scott Atlas, doctor, is a neuroradiologist. Now he's head of a center at Stanford. That's awesome. It's a public policy center. He's a neuroradiologist. He's not an epidemiologist. So that might be a little off-putting. Just to be explicit, this would be, in our Cassandra coefficient, a person who would be considered a false warning just by virtue of his background. Now that said, looking at his work, and this is the great thing, and Tom, we got to figure out how to bridge this, okay? Scott Atlas, now being presented as this person on the right saying this whole thing, I mean, people would probably put this sentence together. Scott Atlas says we're totally overreacting and this is a hoax. That's not what Scott Atlas says at all.
That's right. You're right.
Scott Atlas is saying the same things we're saying over and over, right? The only problem is Scott Atlas seems to be missing the key denominator here, right? So what he's saying is a lot of people get the disease, don't die. You got it, right? It's about, you know, we know the numbers, right? You have to protect older at-risk people. Let's get back to that. And if you do it, you'll prevent hospitals from overrun. You got it. You're not going to get to herd immunity if you isolate everybody. You got it. People are dying because medical care is not getting done for other reasons. Absolutely. Meaning go to the doctor if you think you're having a stroke. Get your preventative medicine. Get your kids immunized for other things now. He's right about that. And finally, which is back to his point number two, we have a clearly defined population at risk that can be protected with targeted measures. So he's saying the same thing we are. This is not a professor from Stanford saying it's a hoax. This is a medical professional who's saying, let's pay attention to some realities here and design our policies around those realities. He's right. But here's the problem. His core, two of his 5 points, say we have to protect vulnerable populations. He's got it, right? There are people over 65 and people with disease who die at this at a rate 1,000 times more than other people, young people, right? Like that's a reality. That's who's dying. A third of the people dying are dying in old folks' homes. A lot of people. Most people who are dying have illnesses. Most people who are dying are older men, right? We have to protect the vulnerable populations. You can't acknowledge we have to do that thing or they die and say we can get back to business as usual till you solve that thing. So every policymaker in the land, you have one job right now. Protect the vulnerable populations, period. That's it. We're not going to have massive rapid testing that works in anytime soon. It ain't happening. That's it's called magical thinking. That's a bias. Well, the testing will show up. We'll be fine. No, it's not coming in the next 6 months. It's not going to be here. We have to protect the vulnerable populations. So he's right. And it's someone on the far left, Rachel Maddow, is probably right. I'm sure if you got them together and said, what need we do? They both would probably agree to this. By the way, anyway, that's the thing. So the problem is, it appears we're so divided and it appears like, oh, I'm a Scott Atlas guy. I agree with the MD from Stanford. Good. So does everybody, every right thinking epidemiologist does too.
Yeah.
This is not a get out of jail free card. Scott Atlas says we should get back to work. No, he doesn't. Scott Atlas says protect your vulnerable populations. Twice. Of his 5 key points, 2 are protect vulnerable populations. And we're not able to do that yet. And if we don't, they're going to die at really, really high rates like they are now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's I react similarly when I read his, you know, his point of view and I watched his point of view. And I think that those questions, I mean, the minute you say that, so I could think of, you know, we've talked about these, my own harebrained ideas about how we could do that. The doing is a big deal. It's a big cultural change. And that's where I think that this notion of, you know, sharing a message and practicing a message that's consistent and effective, it still requires a lot of change. It still requires, I'm on the team. I'll do this the right way. I'm making this up. My kids go to school. They got to do this. I got to deal with my dad in this different way. My dad's in the government program where they have him in a hotel. And here's how we visit him. And here's when we visit. And here's what we don't do. And here's what we do with that elderly teacher. Like my dad teaches high school. You know, he's not going to come back, or, and he's going to do his thing from home while the kids are in a room with a screen. I'm making all this up, but we got to get to that. Right. And we got to get on a page in order to do that. And that's why when every time we say reemergence, reemergence isn't an A or a B, it's an A or a like infinite number of ways we can go about emerging. But I think most people, if A represents no emerge at all, I would say most people, maybe the vast majority of people understand that that's not the choice we can take. Anyway, but
I think there's a message you've done a good job of reminding or teaching to me, Tom, that I think is sort of, and I'd like to figure out how to kind of nail this really tight. It's a horrible time, period, right? We're in a pandemic. This is a hard time. Huge changes are necessary. Self-denial, ostrich effect, saying it's okay, doesn't really matter. Stockdale paradox, saying it'll be over sometime soon, is going to get us mentally unstable and get people killed, right? So let's accept it. This is a shitty, hard time. Hard changes, sacrifices are going to happen. Fine. Now, here's the other part of that. It doesn't mean sacrifices are necessary for a huge number of Americans if we can protect the vulnerable populations. If you're under 65 and healthy, this disease is not profoundly dangerous. If you're not, it is. Just that simple.
Yeah.
So if you're over 65 or under 65 and have what are called comorbidities, basically you take pills, you're overweight or have high blood pressure or diabetes, you need to be locked away and hidden. And that sucks. And that's your dad. And that's my grandparents. That's my dad. Not my grandparents. God rest their souls. And my parents. And I don't know what that means. It might be me. Might be my kids go to school next year and I can't see them because I have pulmonary embolism and I have my own health issues, right? So big sacrifices are going to be necessary. Protecting the vulnerable populations are what we have to do. And if we can do that, then we can get the economy started again. But it's going to be at a cost, and self-denial isn't going to help us.
So RP, as we've been talking, Governor Cuomo has come on. He was just on air, or I think he's still on air. And a couple of things of note, you know, one is he talks about, I guess there's seven, I may have that number wrong, but I think there's seven requirements for different counties to reopen in many cases, or in several cases, there's some that have reached sixth. They're missing that seventh, and that seventh is testing, to your point you were just making, that they don't have the ability to test, and therefore their ability to reopen is thwarted. And interestingly, I guess March 18th, which was sort of the beginning of the real shutdown, we had a death number of 100 and some, I'm talking New York here, and we went way up and now have come way down, and we're back exactly to that number today. So it's an interesting set of news from Cuomo. Interested how you react to that.
So there's a number of states, the East Coast block and the West Coast block and a few others that have created what are probably very medically responsible reopening criteria, New York obviously being one of them inside the East Coast block. The seven New York standards to reopen. The first five of the seven have to do effectively with the curve, flattening the curve as measured by hospitalizations and ICU capacity, et cetera, right? So that gets the idea of let's not have hospitals be overwhelmed. Let's be able to take care of our sick in as best a way we can. And that's obviously very important for lots of reasons. And then the six is about testing and the seventh is about tracing, contact tracing, people who contact tracers who say, oh, Sally was sick. Sally, who are the last 100 people you saw? Let's go make sure we warn all of them, right? So what Cuomo is saying, which is great news in the middle of the state, all seven have been met except the testing one, which is that 30 tests per 1,000 residents performed monthly, 7-day average. And that's too bad that they don't have testing ready, but it's also what we've been saying for a long time, that are pinning our hopes on reopening on testing is a false hope, because accurate, rapid testing is not widely available yet. Now, a comment. The New York list of seven things does not talk about protecting vulnerable populations. Most states have not added protecting vulnerable populations to their list of criteria. It's a huge gap. In fact, you don't have to worry as much about all seven other things on that list if you're protecting vulnerable populations. So I'm hoping that that's something we can shift a lot of attention to. And it's not going to be easy. It'll be expensive. It's going to be hard, but it has to happen.
So RP, tomorrow, we're going to show up with a dashboard that we're going to use every day. It's just an outline of some of the factors states where it's growing straight, states where it's shrinking, updates on all the basics so we can keep people up to date on that. And it can just be a way for us to sort of monitor ourselves as we go along. So we'll build that in for tomorrow. I don't know where I'm going to end up today. I know I'm going that way. That way is south. I am in Missouri. Right over there, that land you can see behind me is Illinois. I don't know what state. I'm going to go to St. Louis today. I know that, but I don't know much more beyond that. But I'll keep everybody up to date. Thank you, RP, for being here.
Have a great time. Put on Big River. You'll love
it. Put it on. I'll put it on. All right. So long.
Take care. Bye.